This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
The night after the game was not the best night of my life. Let me say it like this, but I got up in the morning and I knew I have to speak to my boys, but they were not here. So I texted them a long, long message, pretty much my thoughts about the things that happened. And after that, I felt much better because then it was out, and then we. From that moment on, we could carry on, and that's what we did. And now we are here. We had really enough time to deal with it. And it's losing a game. Come on, you lose a game. It's exactly the opposite of what you want. Losing it with 7-2 makes it, of course, worse. We got a proper knock.
You can lose a game. You don't have to lose immediately 7-2. But in some respect, I like it more than losing 3-2, to be honest, because it's just more clear. The 3-2. And we could have lost that night, 3-2. And then we go home, boys go to the national teams, we have to, we do the analyze, and that's it pretty much. But this is more useful.
Jürgen, you are not sleepy?
Wow, I just thinking about all the positives from our unprecedented 7-2 lost Aston Villa. Wow, amazing! Do you know how many injuries we are having from the game? Zero! I am so really, really proud of the boys. So many beautiful goals.
Welcome to the My Old Man Said podcast, your vaccine to the recent pandemic of Aston Villa podcasts. It was the first full show we've had for a while. After a couple of bonus shows, we will be looking again at the Liverpool game, picking out a few key themes, and looking at the transfer window and other developments since last we spoke. Joining me, Mr. Chris Budd.
Welcome. How you doing? Back.
All right, and Mr. Phil Shaw.
Hello.
Chris, back from his addressing the nation on BBC World.
I was on Global Maneuvers for Mums.
With a Spurs fan who looked a bit of a, well, sounded like a serial killer. I don't know if I could listen to that podcast.
Yeah, it was a bit Charles and Dave, wasn't it? Rabbit, 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 rabbit.
But that's what I didn't understand of that. It was...
We were the headline.
They were billing the Spurs beating Manchester United and the Villa beating Liverpool together as like, which you kind of see, but, you know, Spurs beating 10-man Manchester United. Spurs, who were in the Champions League barely a year ago, Manchester United down to 10 men, deep in transition, you know, not the greatest of team. Meanwhile, a team that escaped relegation on the last day by 1 point, beating the champions and World Club champions 7-2. I mean, what's the story there? I don't know.
They must have had him lined up before we performed miracles.
Yeah. But yeah, thank you for representing villains across the world. I mean, we agreed to do that because... You know, if you ever travelled and you're in a hotel, wherever you are in the world, the BBC World News is always on that hotel TV. So just imagine people having nookie in Singapore or, I don't know, Hong Kong with Chris Budd on their screens in the background.
The dulcet brummy tones.
Some kind of hotel. That's why we did it.
It was the choice of it was the choice of me talking about Villa, info commercials, or adult TV.
One and exactly. The same at Liverpool match.
Well, yeah, it's all that can be on Pornhub as well. Right, coming up in the show, as I said, we will look back at the Liverpool game, but we covered it in that bonus episode 7-2, I think I called it. So do listen to that if you haven't already. It's worth it just for the intro of the Scousers.
That's absolutely majestic by them, by the way.
Reacting to what happened.
Stop scoring!
Stop scoring!
We're already dead!
We'll also look at how the transfer window played out, and we'll also look at how Villa have transformed so quickly in a matter of weeks from that team that was battling relegation to one that has, let's say, a brighter ambition ahead. And under or overrated, we will look at the double talents of Jean McCune. Is it Jean de McCoon?
Jean de McCoon, the second.
Yeah, the second. And Stephen Warnock as well. So we're actually currently in an international week. Phil's celebrating Northern Ireland's first ever penalty shoot. Was it first ever penalty shootout or first ever win in a penalty shootout?
First ever penalty shootout. We have a 100% record. We're better than Germans.
Davis
mentality.
Possible. Davis mentality, yeah. Did Stephen Davis take a penalty?
I can't even remember because at that stage, I wasn't even looking. I know that Liam Boyce scored the last one, considering his rise through Irish League football and then scoring against us for Burton a couple of seasons ago to put us out.
So this is pretty good time for you in terms of being in an international break with 2 weeks of contemplating your football existence. You've got Villa beating Liverpool 7-2 and Northern Ireland getting into the hopefully they'll win the final, but we shall see. But still, it's been a good week for you anyway.
It's just a shame we didn't get to play our southern neighbours in the next round. It would have been a great occasion, but
yeah, no, that would have been fantastic. Yeah, Chris, how's your international week mapped out?
First gig of the year since March coming up. A nice
last
trip to,
gig as well. By the looks
could
of
well
it,
be if the north is being in lockdown. Yeah, so I'm off to Hull this weekend. We shall see what's that like. If to use a football analogy, there's no way I'm going to be match fit. luckily, I'll be done by 9:30.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. It's not as if
it's not exactly an early hours
test.
Of the morning job, is it?
Danny Drinkwater special.
Yeah, it will be like a loaf of bread on stage.
Well, good luck with that anyway. Right, let's get into the show. Villa news. First of all, nothing happening on deadline day was never expected anyway, but we have in the final days of and final hours of the transfer window offloaded Mr. Jota and Euler Nyland. So we no longer have to try to pronounce his name correctly. Nyland, I don't know if he's found a club yet. I haven't followed that up, but Jota's off to Deportivo Alavés. Expected, they weren't really going to feature.
I think, do you know what? Nyland's had more than a fair crack at the whip. I think, he had his amazing moments in the cup run and nobody will take that away from him and, fair play. But for the journey that the Villa are now on, he's not going to be a step up, is he? So good luck to the guy.
Yeah, I think it was his time to go. I mean, he's not going to hit the heights that he's already hit for Villa. I mean, he's done the best that he can do for Villa. I mean, he'll always be remembered for the cup run and the game against Sheffield United last season. So, cult hero status achieved.
Yeah, I mean, some of the saves in that semi-final were fantastic. It was a great display. But alas, for day in, day out Premier League games, there was always a mistake in him, and that was the problem there.
Yeah, and with Jota, he was only he was brought in as a squad player initially, he was a very cheap, easy option, and he had a couple of moments, and again, fair play, good luck to the guy. Apparently, he wasn't wasn't much trouble other than Danny Drinkwater. So
yeah. Anyway, moving on, international break saw kind of a reversal in. What used to be, certainly in the early 2000s, a bit of a problem. Villa players taking penalties on international duty. John McGinn scored in Scotland's win that sets them up for a game against Serbia. As Scotland beat Israel on penalties, Northern Ireland weren't the only team to triumph from the home nations. Conor Hourihan scored his penalty, but unfortunately Ireland were knocked out. Meanwhile, as I always said, Grealish would play against Wales. I was saying that months ago. And he got an assist, as did Tyrone Mings, and Grealish Grealish also picked up the Man of the Match award, which I think is Player of the Match nowadays.
Yeah, as did McGinn, of course. McGinn got Man of the Match as well, didn't he?
Yeah, and then Grealish didn't get picked for the Belgium game, as expected. You know, it's baby steps because to play in the position that he's currently in at Villa, you know, he's the front line is pretty much set in stone in terms of England, isn't it?
With Kane, so, yeah, on the left hand side of midfield, and
Rashford,
Sterling,
Sancho, yeah. Sterling are his really his front three assets.
And I think, you know, he obviously more than staked a claim in the Wales game, and you know, deservedly would have, you know, got Man of the Match. But just from a purely selfish perspective, I was actually glad to see him not feature. You know, I think he'd carried a couple of little niggly knocks. You think, do you know what? If you can get him a rest, get him a rest. Just from a purely selfish Villa point of view,
you know, he hasn't earned the right to be the top man yet, because there's plenty of, you know, more from him to come.
Oh, completely, man. He's got another gear, definitely.
And we've seen that in the Liverpool performance. And, you know, once he starts chalking that up regularly, Southgate will definitely have to get him in there somewhere. But ultimately, as long as he's in there for the tournament at the end of the season, that's what he should be aiming for.
Agreed. He's more than staked his claim, and I think he's put it out there to the wider nation now that everybody knows what he can do now. He's very much on the radar.
So Villa players doing all right on international duty. And I referenced Villa players not being so great at penalties because, I mean, Euros 2004, Vissel missed a penalty against Portugal. Olof Mellberg missed the deciding kick against Holland for Sweden in the same tournament. Obviously, Southgate was a Villa man when he missed against Germany in 96 as well. Villa players at that time just didn't have the luck on their side, but that seems to have changed. Moving on to other news, Villa's youngsters, under-21s, again found it very hard going in the EFL Trophy. EFL Trophy is the bottom two leagues, and certain youth teams from Premier League outfits. After getting slapped by Sunderland, they got beat 3-0 by Fleetwood, and they were 3-0 down in the first 15 minutes, again showing you, you know, Louis Barry's in the team. Doesn't really matter. It's there is a big gap. So anybody calling for these 16, 17-year-olds to be playing for Villa's first team, it's a bit of a reality check to that kind of tomfoolery. In other news, COVID-19 hits Aston Villa as the women's team confirmed that one of their first team squad tested positive, which means other members of the squad now have to enter a period of self-isolation, and they've agreed with the FA to postpone their next two fixtures against Bristol and Chelsea. So hopefully that doesn't have any more repercussions in spreading anywhere else. Villa ladies still looking for their first win of the Super League, although they did get their first win in the Continental League Cup after beating Sheffield United, who are in the division below. So hopefully that will give them a bit of confidence. But they will probably be bottom of the table when they return. I mean, they're second to bottom on goal difference. So there's that. But then you've got 2 weeks to maybe a bit more, let's say, preparation and going over any of the problems. I mean, the problem with the Women's Super League is almost like two leagues within one. You've got your Arsenal, Everton, Chelsea, Manchester City ladies, or Manchester United as well, who are at the top there, just trouncing anybody from the bottom half that they play. So you've got three teams out of the 12 are on 0 points at the moment, and with mounting goal differences. So it is a bit of a two-tier system within the top tier.
And you see Arsenal's ladies there, they've scored 18 goals in their three games, so that tells you all you need to know.
Yeah, no, it's plus 15 goal difference. A bit like Villa, really, in the Premier League, with their plus 9 over three games. Another relevant piece of information in terms of Villa news. The Premier League, after the pressure of supporters asking for games that weren't scheduled for TV to be screened so they could actually watch them somehow, the Premier League have said yes to that, but they've sprung a pay-per-view fee of £14.95 on them. Cue backlash, and the, you know, that price is it's taken the piss, really. We'll discuss this on other shows, but I mean, people are making the foolish comparison with, you know, live games, saying, oh, yeah, but it's only a fraction of that and you save money by not going to the game. No, you should be comparing it, you know, apples with apples. And look at what, you know, Sky do in terms of the day pass, where for $9.99 you can watch the game that you want if you're not subscribed to Sky or BT, and you also get, you know, 24 hours of Sky Sports and, you know, potentially another two or three games in that period. So that's the blueprint of what you get for your money. And, you know, comparing it to say, oh yeah, but we have more cameras than the EFL's pay-per-view £10, you know, that's just a smokescreen when fans not on the Sky and BT platform have been paying £10 for games with crowds and, you know, much superior product. So for a downgrade with no crowd, etc.
The cameras thing's bollocks, isn't it? Because you, you're going to watch Match of the Day that evening. It's like, well, well done, Sky. Yeah. You might be showing it live, but Match of the Day will have the highlights on and they'll use all the camera angles. Or even the highlights will. The highlights on YouTube.
The cameras are already
free.
There. It's a desperate bid to justify.
Well, it's the clubs trying to offset some of the lost match day revenues, isn't it? They're not charging for premium games. This isn't like, you know, like, for example, I saw an example, someone comparing it to, like, you know, an Anthony Joshua fight or, you know, a big boxing fight. But it's like they're one-off singular events and they are the premier events. You know, it's not like pay-per-view for a World Cup final or a Champions League final. This is like, you know, Burnley v Southampton or...
It's a bit of a disgrace. I mean, it should be no more than £10. I think if they said £10, I don't think you have such an outcry. But the Premier League, you know, they voted on this, but the votes the clubs had was, it was always £14.95. There was no options in terms of different pricing points. Anyway, hopefully you've got an Amazon Fire Stick already, or there's plenty of links around... Not that we'd advocate such a thing, but as supporters, we are being pushed into this because that price point is a joke. Right then, moving on to the 3 points that you may have seen that the Premier League have actually put out an open letter to the government. Letters back, hashtag letters back for fans to return to football. This has been supported, actually, when you say Premier League, that means all the 20 members of the Premier League, which are all the club, all the stakeholders have pushed this out. I mean, I've received an email as part of the fan consultation group asking me to spread the petition. A fan has put out one of those government petitions where you need over 100,000 to get it debated at the House of Commons. I think it got over 100,000 pretty swiftly. So the Football Supporters Association is behind this as well, and all the other leagues, the Women's League, the EFL. But I don't know. The situation is the COVID issue, you know, we're going into winter now and it's not looking good. So the timing of this, while you appreciate something needs to be happening to save, especially the lower tiers and the grassroots tiers, the reality is, you just look at anything from like universities who, you know, will skip back into business as usual and then suddenly now they're closing down face-to-face lectures and they've got people in halls locked up in isolation. And the reality is, you know, we're on no way, shape or form out of the woods. And I think in this situation, you're kind of waiting for after winter just to, you know, see what happens, because it's not going to get, you can't turn a blind eye to the problem.
No, it feels like we're treading water, doesn't it, really, for the next few months now?
Yeah, I think what triggered it was the announcement that the Royal Albert Hall would be at 50% capacity in December, and it's indoors, and, you know, if you could have that many in there, you could imagine grounds at 50% capacity, that would be that would almost be acceptable. Especially since they're outdoor, but it's the consideration of that many fans getting to the ground. I mean, inside the ground, you may be able to police everything, but getting to and from it.
And in and around the ground, isn't it? It's concourses and everyone leaving.
And
the
problem is, this
is
never mentioned. The people are, you know, doing their sound bites on TV or whatever. They don't mention that. This is, you know, this is the wider picture. And, you know, up north now, it's talking about, you know, localized restrictions, etc., and you're getting into a state really of lockdown, but that's the dirty word that nobody wants to return to. But yeah, I'm kind of torn. I mean, you know, I should be banging the drum on this being on the council of the Football Supporters Association, but you know, I can't go all in because there's a wider discussion and implication to this. It is a week by week thing, the actual situation, but I wouldn't be making any legislation to get back into football without seeing what happens at, say, halfway into November at least. Moving on to point number two, I think Dan mentioned, did he mention this or did I?
Yeah, it's a discussion we'd had with Dan, wasn't it, previously?
Offer on, yeah, it's just an American entertainment agency, ICM, have bought out the Stella Group, which is a London-based sports agency that represents over 800 athletes, including Mr. Jack Grealish and Gareth Bale, I think seven England players all in. And their, you know, their contracts are worth about $3 billion, £2.36 billion. So the idea is this group. They also have like other brands. So the idea of they have actors and musicians, etc., which are used for branding and advertising and whatever. So the idea is to diversify their potential for their brands by using sports stars as well. So, considering the effects of COVID, it's kind of they obviously still think that it's a strong potential marketing vehicle. So expect Grealish to appear in adverts and marketing. What do you think you'll end up doing in an ideal world?
Crunching at cornflakes.
I would definitely have him doing Brill Cream, and not just modern Brill Cream, old school, the one you want
to like spice.
Yeah, or the one you could cook chips with that you just sort of slap on the hair, and that's Jack sorted. Or there's bound to be some calf compressions for running sleeves that he can do.
Maybe not bringing back the who wears short shorts. Jack wears short shorts.
The possibilities are endless. Gareth Bale and Titleist or something for golf is just, it's right there. Make it happen.
So, those gentlemen will be receiving more money, no doubt, with that kind of agency backing. Right, point number three. Every team has a mascot, but I've always liked Gunnosaurus and the Arsenal dinosaur mascot. And the news went out that Arsenal had basically ditched him, stopped paying Gunnosaurus. And, he was the last member of the Arsenal's Invincibles team. So it's like
the end of an era.
Because the photos of them celebrating their league title when they went the whole season without getting beaten, Gunnosaurus is in that picture.
I'm surprised he was paid. I thought he would have done it just for the love of being Gunnosaurus.
Well, no, everybody's going to eat. But
these costumes don't pay for themselves, Phil.
Phil, I know you think he's real, but there's actually a person inside the Gunnosaurus. So somebody in the outfit, it's like, I don't want to ruin Christmas for everybody, but it's actually somebody dressed up as Santa Claus. Oh, yeah, sorry. There might be children listening to this podcast, but it's really is a symbol of football cutbacks. But knight in shining armour, Mesut Ozil has offered to pay the wages of Gunnosaurus. Great PR for him. It's won the hearts and minds of many Arsenal fans, especially on social media. I think the compromise here is he's been left out of the Europa League squad. What else is he doing? He should be Gunnosaurus.
I think so. Arsenal need to get their money's worth, don't they? When they're paying him, a few hundred grand a week.
Yeah,
and that was the underlying thing of the story, wasn't it? That Arsenal had sacked their mascot and about 50 other members of staff, and yet they were trying to bring in new footballers on, six-figure sums a week.
Yeah.
And there was a certain moral issue with that.
They're not getting rid of Gunnosaurus to, like, pay for Willian's wages, are they?
You'd hope not.
I'd probably have Gunnosaurus over Willian.
Have him over Ozil at the moment. He probably does more on a match day.
I think Maitland-Niles, I'd have Gunnosaurus over him, because he was... you see somebody like Jack Grealish playing for England against Wales, enjoying it, looked like he'd been playing for England for many a year, and Maitland-Niles just seemed a bit kind of excitable. His first touch was he was missing, and some of his timing of his runs are a bit off as well. So yeah, maybe Maitland-Niles, ship him out, save the money, keep Gunnosaurus. But yeah, or alternately, Ozil, let him do it, get in the suit, son.
When's Henry getting in the Hercules' suit?
Yeah, Mr. Lansbury, there is a job for you. If we don't manage to ship you out,
we'll even let him keep a number 8 in the back of Hercules. It'll be fine.
Who's going to be Bella?
Yeah, if we don't ship you out by the end of October 16, then Hercules is your new job. If you don't see him on the bench, he's in the suit. Before we go on to the main part of the show, I just want to give a huge thanks, as always, to the My Old Man Said patrons who keep the show going. First off, a big shout out for the new patrons, Nicholas NC. Please do send your full surnames in so you can get a proper shout out. Matt Chapman, David Ryder, John Romby, Jordan Crawley, Stephen Fanner, Luke Roberts, Stuart Penton, Daniel Baddeley, Charlie Bernal, David Hardman, and Alex Hamilton. Also, at the moment, you can sign up upfront for a year and you save 2 months by doing that. 15% it works out at. So a big thank you for the recent annual subscribers. Azrael, John Burley, Jamie Thomas, Matthew Smith Lilly, Rob Hayes, Tony Keane, and from down under, Ian Wiseman. A big thank you for all signing up for the year. You can now, as a patron, you can actually pay in euros, pounds, or dollars. So thank you very much for those who have actually upgraded. Eleanor Peters, Andy Williams, Matt Deacon, Gary Barr, Keenan Dimmick, Alan Blisecker, Wes Roach, and Ben Hipkiss. If you want to join us and get extra shows and also access to Match Club, first rule of Match Club is you can't talk about Match Club, but it's a bit like a live podcast everybody can join in on. If you fancy a piece of that, our private little club that meets for matches, please do go to myoldmansaid.com and click on the patron link to get more details and sign up there. Thank you very much.
Jack Grealish is looking for another, and it is seven! The captain gets his second. This is a day of dreams for Aston Villa.
Main bit of the show. Let's talk about we've said quite a lot actually for a reaction show in the last podcast about Aston Villa 7, Liverpool 2, 7 fucking 2. But it's been interesting to see the kind of reaction, the fallout. I mean, we're just going to take a couple of themes with hindsight, as opposed to going through the game all the way. Just listen to the other podcast for that. Without the crowd, how did that affect the situation? That's the first theme we'll look at. I mean, if you looked at Spurs beating Manchester United at Old Trafford, you looked at Leicester beating Manchester City 5-2 at the Etihad, and suddenly you've got your headlines for saying that no crowd has made home advantage disappear. But if there was a crowd at Villa Park, would it have been the same score? Would it have been more? Would it have been less? I mean, what do you think?
I think it's really hard to gauge, because I remember we spoke about this very, very early on in COVID, about one of the big things that you would find potentially was at key moments of matches when that momentum can shift. And, you know, especially like, say, when you've got the backs to the wall and you need that extra lift from the crowd, or when you're getting on top and the crowd can really pull you over the line. You haven't got that. But actually, you saw that in the real key moments of the game, when the game could have turned, like, you know, when Salah got the first Liverpool goal back, Villa went up the other end and scored the third. Well, the crowd weren't there for that. Or, you know, when you come out in the second half and it's 4-1, Liverpool are still just about in the game, but Villa went and got the fifth and killed the game. So it's kind of, the Villa game is such an anomaly on so many levels, really.
Yeah, because if you remember when the first introduction of football after the, you know, lockdown pandemic period was the Bundesliga, and, you know, when after two or three games they were looking over the results, the trend was, yeah, there was more away wins. So you could say that it has nullified the home advantage. But then, you know, the Villa game comes along and it just makes a mockery of that in many respects. I mean, if a crowd was there, I think that, you know, you got the celebrations, there's more of an emotional release, you got players potentially jumping into the crowd to that. I mean, you suddenly got a different game, because that's suddenly affected it already. The restart, the kickoff's going to be not as quick, and you might lose a bit of that momentum. And, you know, Villa, bang, 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 7 goals, but it's because they just kept going. It was almost like a training exercise, rather than if you get swept up with the emotion, you know, the whole end would have gone crazy after 3-1 for sure. And you might, you know, lose a bit of focus, and there might be, just for the crowd's benefit, inclination to defend that lead to make sure you got the win, just so you don't piss off the crowd. The fact there was no crowd there probably created a bit of a freedom just to keep going.
It's either a freedom or it's an excuse, maybe. I mean, When I was trying to consume as much media, you know, on the radio and TV after the great win, it all came around the same thing. You maybe had three or four pundits saying, oh, it's definitely the crowd. The crowd are making this. It's the crazy season. This is why it is. But you always had one, you know, probably sour-faced pundit somewhere saying, these players are looking any excuse to just cover up from the fact of poor defending. So is it the crowd not shouting man on? Is it things like that? Do the defenders, are they not switched on? Are they too relaxed because they don't seem to be up for it? I mean, the Villa game was one thing. Liverpool's defence was high, but there wasn't very many individual errors in it apart from the goalkeeper in the very first goal. More of the United game. I mean, it was just Keystone Cops. It was horrific to watch.
Yeah, I mean, was it the second goal or the first goal? Crazy.
First goal was my personal favourite. Harry Maguire, the head tennis, and then
The first one.
Luke Shaw's about to clear the ball, and Harry Maguire tries to pull back a Spurs player and grabs Luke Shaw instead and pulls him back, leaving the Spurs player to tuck it in. I mean, it's one of the moments of the season already.
Yeah, so it is a difficult one to put your finger on. It's still, I think you probably need a bigger source. Sample, i.e. a whole season, but it's definitely, as Chris said, it's a bit of an anomaly of a game in that respect. Could this have happened in a normal season? Well, it hasn't really happened before. I mean, Villa did beat Liverpool when they were the champions in the 76-77 season. They were 5-1 up at half time there, and that's another interesting thing. We were 4-1 up at half time this time, but we just carried on in the second half pretty much the same as the first half. Normally, as is, it's almost like football lore, if you go 4-0 up very early and that's the half-time result, normally the game does finish 4-0. The second half is normally 0-0 because there's a lack of intensity from the players, the job's, you know, already done. The opposition's so beaten that they can't be asked to do anything. So it's almost like you play out the final 45 minutes. I think, what did Smith say? That there was a surreal atmosphere, obviously being 4-1 up. But you know what they do at halftime? They have a video feed and they go through some of the highlights just to reinforce points that are actually doing well, or they may maybe not be doing so well. But they kind of kept the tempo up and carried on. We talked about the high line situation and how Villa dealt with that. But there was also a change in what Villa did once they got in possession or once they won the ball back, which would be interesting to see if that was just to purposely target the high line by playing, you know, when you get the ball, to get it up as quickly as possible or to drive it up. Or normally you win the ball back, you're looking to establish possession, especially Villa, you know, play it out wide, play it front, then it gets played back, or you play it back to the keeper to restart it. But all that does is allow the defense to reset on the other side. While Villa weren't doing that this game, they were just getting, you know, they were attacking. As soon as they got the ball, they just went for the throat every time. You think that's something we'll see because now we have Barkley to drive more, and Grealish has more options, and, you know, Watkins is always a live wire in giving you an out ball wherever you are? Do you think that's something we'll see in the next few games, or do you think it was just mainly to make sure that high line didn't have chance to settle and set up to entrap us?
It could be a bit of both, you know, because I think that you saw Villa play with pace and tempo. You know, they moved the ball quickly. They got up the field. They played through the phase of the field, and they got through Liverpool's press, which, you know, is pretty famous. So the fact that they didn't have Mane at the top of the field starting that press probably made a difference. They didn't have Henderson enforcing it in the middle again made a difference. Likes of Barkley got us up the field quickly. Grealish could carry the ball. McGinn could carry the ball. Trezeguet did on numerous occasions as well. I think that other teams might necessarily become a little bit wiser to that, and they'll say, well, there's no point in playing a high line against Villa because they've got Watkins who can run in behind, whereas last season, you know, you had Davies or Wesley or Samatta who weren't going to do that.
Yeah.
Trezeguet looks quicker. So all of a sudden, we've just got a little bit of, like, I've previously called it straight line speed. You know, we can just actually cover ground quicker. Some teams might decide that actually we need to play a little bit deeper against Villa and keep them playing in front of us, which, well, I think actually with the players we've got, we can do as well.
Yeah, that's very important because it's the whole mindset that other teams come into playing against Villa with. Because last season you were thinking to yourself, oh, Villa, they start well, but just, you know, keep them within touch until the last half hour and we'll score maybe 1, 2, 3 because they just let it go at the end. If the narrative going in, if other teams have it in their head, this Villa team, you can't let them break on us, you can't let them carry the ball. If we get all our teams sitting deep against us and we can suddenly unlock these deep defences, the league's our oyster.
Are you talking about, like, there's going to be a lot of tactical fouls against us to stop us starting up such attacks?
I think so, yeah. I mean, you saw that, didn't you? And I know Barkley got clattered, didn't he, by Van Dijk at one point, and then McGinn got fouled numerous times. Louise, obviously Grealish always gets fouls. I think teams will be thinking, we need to, if Villa pick the ball up on the edge of their penalty area, take the foul there rather than letting them get into our know, third of the field.
I think Smith has already maybe foreseen this, because we look at the two free kicks that we've scored from. The one against Fulham, you've seen Mings put it in his Instagram, you know, Sunday. This was the setup on Sunday I scored from it. And then here's the setup in the match, exactly the same that I scored from. And then the Watkins hat-trick goal, his third goal, that free kick, I've looked at it a good few times. Trezeguet starts off so far away from what you would, the Liverpool defence would consider the danger zone. And as soon as Barkley whips that ball in, Trezeguet's gone. He has to go at full pace, cover about 20 yards, and just perfectly times it to reach the ball on the byline to cross the cross for Watkins. You can't defend against that free kick. So if we know we're going to get free kicks in that position, we can have Barkley to whip it in now from anywhere on the right. And then if Horahan or McGinn do it from the left, you know, we're catered for every situation. We're well prepared.
I'd agree with that. I mean, you said it previously, David, with the fact that all of a sudden Smith has got the ammo. You know, he's got the toolbox to go and actually set his team up how he wants, and he can have a plan A, B, and C, and we can have an individual tactic for each game. Whereas I think this, certainly the first half of last season, it was, this is the way Villa play, and we're just going to try and believe in it as best we can. And you saw when the belief in the plan A went, we didn't have the plan B yet. Whereas now we have the alternatives. We saw that, you know, post lockdown.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Just a final point on the Liverpool game, which hopefully will blossom in further games. It was just, it's the first game together, but Barkley and Grealish looked like they were almost having a laugh playing together.
Had a great time.
Yeah, like proper enjoying themselves. As I said about Grealish in the England game, he looked really relaxed there as well.
There's a natural sort of telepathy, wasn't there, with him and Barkley? And I think, I'm sure we said it as well, you know, the Grealish getting in the squad previously and then getting his first appearance under his belt, and then, of course, he got the new contract. I think he's had a lot of weight lifted off his shoulders, both on the field and off it.
Well, it's like his future's a bit clearer now, because he knows that realistically he looks around him now in that Villa team and he goes, oh, actually, I've got a vehicle here to do something.
Yeah. And long may that continue.
I mean, people were getting really excited about, you know, the stats last season, and a lot of the time it was using secondary stats, especially to go after Gareth Southgate. You know, most chances created, whatever. But I always said, what in real terms, what does that actually mean? Because here we are surviving relegation by, 1 point, but apparently we've had all these chances, which when you watch the games, you never really saw it. And you saw Grealish having a lot of off days, or let's say not having the influence that he could have potentially had. But a lot of it, you know, wasn't his fault, because he didn't have the players to really open up his imagination and his full potential. You know, I would mention David Platt's 20 goals from midfield as, like, that's what, back in the day, that's what proper stats are. None of these secondary stats to kind of boost somebody. But Grealish will be getting closer to that. And you're going to be astounded, I think, by his stats this season. If he doesn't get injured, his assists and goals will be on another level to what he got last season. If so, then Villa are in a different ballpark in terms of the league table as well.
I mean, you've seen in the England match, the bit of it that I sort of glanced at whenever Northern Ireland were winning, Grealish was the only player that carried the ball in a dribble. I mean, this obsession with passing, a bit of me almost doesn't want Gareth Southgate to coach him if he's going to turn him into this sort of passing robot rather than a dynamic midfielder, because with Barkley, we have Grealish, we have McGinn, ball at their feet. They're 10 yards immediately up the pitch with the ball at their feet before they're even looking
at pass. Unless some Welshman's kicking you. I think if Grealish, as long as he can get on the pitch in the Euros, I think he'll be able to do what he wants, because it's when player power takes over a little bit more, is actually when you're deep in the tournaments. Because I think there is a bit of caution to Southgate. I mean, I'm not going to get into the Southgate bashing. I'm quite happy to cut him some slack, but we'll see in the Euros if Southgate's actually got his team together and he's got his best 11 together, what actually happens. But I think Grealish is somebody who, in the middle of a tournament on his day, could suddenly take over.
Well, we said all along he's just a different option, and that's all you need from a player like Jack. He doesn't necessarily have to be, the first name on the team sheet. There are some very good players in those positions, but because he offers you something different, he is a weapon to be taken to a major tournament.
Yeah. Going back to the Villa context, it's a different world now we're in terms of Grealish. I mean, he now, Barkley instantly gives you that, but also Watkins. We can't underestimate the role of Watkins. And
a striker with movement.
Yeah, Smith said to, I think in an interview that, he said that Grealish had a word with him earlier, and he said he's actually way better when you play with him in training than you'd ever expect. But we'll talk a bit more about Watkins in a second. But yeah, overall, I think those two together, I'm looking forward to watching those two against Leicester, Grealish and Barkley against Leeds, etc. Because surely that can only get better. If that was the evidence of their first game together, then we should be in for a bit of a treat. As long as Barkley sorts out his shooting. Sorry, there was another point I wanted to make about this. A lot of talk about, from the neutrals and some Liverpool fans, about the deflected goals, and we were a bit lucky. We had three deflected goals. I mean, we'd have still won. Whether they went in or not. But we also had three or four gilt-edged chances that should have been put away. And I think most Liverpool fans aren't going to complain about what happened in terms of that. Because if you don't shoot, you don't buy a ticket to the lottery. So, it's fair enough. And I think that's a coincidence that we had three deflected goals. But I think McGinn's would have gone in anyway. That was going bottom corner.
Yeah, and Klopp says himself in his interview that a deflected goal is a poor block by the defender, so he's no problem with it.
No, exactly. Anyway, I'm looking forward to the Anfield game, the dynamic of what Liverpool will be thinking. Like, we've got to get revenge. But they can't just beat us, though, because they'd normally do that anyway. They've got to really destroy us to get some kind of revenge. So that's going to leave them open again, I think, for another battering.
Not that we're getting ahead of ourselves or anything.
Well, no, I suppose there is other games this season, but I'm kind of intrigued to see what happens.
I'm just hoping
Anfield.
We're sharpening our tools for the arrival of Man United.
Yeah, I'd like to beat them 7-2 as well.
Or more.
Right, anyway, moving on. Just quickly, I mean, we speak about this all the time, but in terms of the club's change in situation now, I think the media still kind of think of us as that team that just escaped relegation. So that's how they still view us, because it's a bit of it's like turning a big ship in terms of mainstream punditry, let's say. Let's start at the start of lockdown. At the start of the lockdown, we weren't that, it wasn't looking good at all. And the reorganization of the defense and all the Zoom meetings and everything that needed to be put in action, and you need to play games to kind of get that down. And they eventually got that, let's say the last four games. Other teams lacking in intensity and motive, so it's a perfect time to play most of those teams that we did play. It's because we had a mission, and perhaps Arsenal, West Ham, Everton and the likes didn't at that stage. But now, since then, I think you've got that defensive organisation now. I think a big thing is Craig Shakespeare coming in as well, and the transfer business that we've done. Anything else you can put down the change in the club's outlook and ambition?
I think Smith's spoken numerous times about culture. I think you've had to embed not just players on the field, but you've had to embed lots of different personalities off it. You've had to get guys up to speed with the culture, some of them with that, guys like Louise with the language. Just getting everyone to settle. You look at what's happened with sort of Trezeguet post-lockdown, you can see the work online that he's been doing, because he's been putting videos of him working out and just getting everybody fitter. And it just feels like a team and a club slash organisation that just feels a little bit more leaner and meaner, and everyone's going in the right direction now.
Yeah, because I've written about this, but you know, people have written off our transfer business, 13 players in, was rubbish, you know, because they almost got relegated. And you know, some fans are thinking this as well, but people forget that these players, if they're good players, that you know, they don't start off the first game as soon as they sign like at the top of their ability. You know, they're human after all. You've got to learn the system, learn how to, you know, how to play with these teammates that you've suddenly you know, you're playing with 10 players you haven't played with before. Also, you're kind of settling in to a new, whether it's a country or a new league. And of course, you're going to be a hell of a lot better in a year's time with a season under your belt. That goes without saying. So we've seen that. I mean, Mings, I think, would be better. Cons are definitely better. Luiz, definitely better. Trezeguet, definitely better. So this transfer window that you've written off as, oh yeah, that was a load of crap because they've almost got relegated. If that's how you're thinking, then you know nothing about football.
No, I think it's a trust thing, and it goes all through the club, you could say. It's a Smith trusts the players maybe trust Smith now to make tactical switches. And whenever the player trusts the person beside him, he's less likely to try and sort of cover for a mistake they might make. I mean, you can see last season Mings was blocking everything because he was basically going about like a blue ball across the back four, just blocking this, and he was never in the position that he needed to be in. Now, if he trusts Konza, if he trusts Cash, and he trusts Target to be where they should be, he can be where he should be, and then that just translates the whole way up the pitch.
I mean, you're naturally getting better, and also you've gone through experiences. Well, let's say, like, you know, half of the team have gone through the promotion. Now they've all gone through defeat and relegation, so they've had a lot of highs together, which intensifies the bond and the trust, as you just mentioned. So it's an ongoing, evolving, improving thing. So you've got that, and now you've added some quality to it, and your experience. And as we mentioned on the previous show, Smith has kind of reappraised his approach and started to think more defensively as well to get that balance right. And that's a further element of the evolution, which brings us to a team that actually you can now see how Leicester suddenly transformed after a transition season after they got promoted. You can see how Graham Taylor turned it around. You can see how Ron Atkinson, after that, you know, I'd call it a calibration season, where it's calibrating a team that has potential, that calibration can take place in a relegation battle. And the next season, the transformation can be pretty spectacular. I mean, Leicester's, it's going to be hard to top that one.
The league is there for the taking. I mean, whether it's what we talked about earlier with the no crowds and some teams not able to motivate themselves, there's nobody in that league that you fear at the minute anyway. Nobody has got, apart from ourselves and Everton, nobody has turned up to this league sort of switched on.
No, exactly. And that result will go a long, long way to make us not fear anybody. So Phil Shaw's talking about the title. What about you, Bud?
I sort of, I remember saying numerous times at the start, anything from about 10th to 14th is achievable. I think
there's a big spectrum.
Yeah, there's a big opportunity. I think that's the word this season.
Let's say Europe is not out of the question.
I mean, that's the thing. Who knows this season? It's so early, and
Wolves can jump up.
Yeah, completely. And Southampton had a good run. I think the fact that all of a sudden we look like we've got goals in the team, you've always got a chance.
And we're not conceding. The defence is pretty resolute. So the only thing, league title, we're kind of joking because we don't have the depth of squad. But that's the only disadvantage we have at the moment. If we can get ourselves around those upper echelons, we've still got the January window, so you could potentially reinforce to kick on. But all I'm saying, I mean, we'll leave it now, but it's more of an open season than you might first think if you have the mentality of thinking about what happened last season. Forget about last season. This is different gravy.
And we've got momentum. And momentum is so key. That's what happened with Leicester. And I mean, I'll go back very quickly to, you know, 94, 95, stayed up on the last day. 95, 96, we beat Man United on the first day. And straight away, the players believe, and you start the season well that season as well. And you get that bit of momentum. And it was the same with Leicester. You know, they beat Villa, didn't they? I mean, we were 2-0 up at the bloody King Power that year. And and ended up losing, and Leicester suddenly got a bit of momentum and they just kept on believing. And then it just comes down to things like a bit of luck with injuries and suspensions and stuff like that, which you have very little control over. But once you get the belief and the momentum going, who knows? I mean, that's what happened with Wolves when they got promoted as well.
Anyway, so we'll see what happens. But the good news is it's exciting again.
And that's all you want, isn't it? Just to see your team getting in and amongst it again.
Yeah. I mean, just quickly, we touched on it there, but the transfer window appraisal, I mean, out of 10, what would you give it?
I'd give it maybe something like 8 or 9.
Yeah. Phil?
I'll go 8, because I do think we need a sub striker. I know it's hard to find a striker that's happy with being on the bench, but I think we do need cover there. But it's definitely... You know, you bought players for the here and now rather than potential.
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at themes, I mean, we're purchasing like oven-ready footballers for the English league. We're not going and taking money ball punts on Belgium league players. I mean, like Martinez he's won a couple of trophies in the month before that he signed for us in the FA Cup and the Community Shield. Cash, you know. Player of the Championship, I think, was that?
Yeah, Watkins, I mean, Cash and Watkins, you're looking at probably two of the best players in the Championship last year in terms of form and their stats and their level of consistency. Barkley's proven at this level.
Yeah.
And really, it's only Traore.
Even Traore, I mean, he played for Chelsea before, so he knows...
Yeah.
He knows the league as well. I mean, like with Watkins, I mean, we kind of did look at the price and think, because that, you know, As we've mentioned previously on the podcast, Villa with the team when they were in the Championship that actually inflated prices by just throwing, you know, 12 million at the Hogans, your McCormacks, everything inflated on top of that. So we were kind of responsible for the, we were record Championship. I think McCormack broke the record, didn't it, initially?
Yeah.
And then went on from there. But you looked at Watkins, and I think that, if you're just going pure stats, okay, he scored 26 goals playing centre-forward, but the interesting thing was he was caught scoring double figures from the wing as well when he played before that in the previous season. So it shows you that there is a player who is actually a good player because he's doing that from whatever position he's in. Right, let's move on and close the show out with our traditional segment of underrated or overrated. Right, underrated or overrated is where we look back at Villa players of recent history, shall we say, last few decades, and reappraise them and see if our memories are clouded by hindsight or mythology or propaganda that has since turned them into legends when maybe they didn't even play 100 games, mentioning no names. But first up, we're going to do a completely random choice here. Jean McCoon and Stephen Warnock. Who should we go for first?
Let's get Jean McCoon out of the way.
Yeah, it's not going to take long, is it? He's only played, like, made nine appearances. Not many of those were starts either. Why did we buy Mr. Jean McCoon from... we got him from Lyon, though.
Yeah, he was a good player there for, you know, over a couple of seasons, and he was he'd done well at Lille before. I think Julian.
Where we got Traore from?
Yeah,
and Jean Carew.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it was during the halfway through the season when Julian realised that Villa were potentially going to be in a relegation fight. He needed a player that fitted his style of play, very much a possession-based deep-line midfielder who could tackle as well. And on the face of it, it did look like a good signing.
Yeah, I mean, he was like Cameroon international. I mean, Lyon back in that period, no slouches. I liked him. I mean, he just looked a likeable character with his magic jumpers.
He did tick a lot of boxes when he was announced. When as signed, you were thinking to yourself, yeah, well, this will get us out of trouble this season. We can start kicking on. But alas, it didn't turn out.
Because we were always looking for that kind of player, somebody to sit on the base of the midfield and almost like an orchestra, you know.
Yeah, it was somebody who could run the game. We just didn't have it at that time.
No,
we had a bit of a ropey mid. Well, we were losing players.
We were that season, you know. But obviously, yeah. We'd lost Milner. Young was still there. Downing was there, and he would have left. But we'd lost
but
obviously
in the
Petrov
of the
in
park,
that season,
yeah.
Because of course Petrov had had his, you know, his health problem.
Yeah, so you lost Milner and Petrov. So we were lacking something in the middle. So we were really rebuilding the middle of the park, and that was the first attempt. And then of course. Julier had Johan Cabaye lined up, which would have happened, but then because he had his heart attack, Kabaye ended up going to Newcastle and had his best season there. I think since he left Newcastle, it was just downhill all the way for because he was pretty tasty.
He was
at
a
Newcastle.
Really good player, Kabaye,
wasn't it? And that would have been him at Villa, and that would have transformed us. And who knows what would have happened under Houllier after that? He'd have got rid of Gabby.
I'm sure,
because from recent Gabby Gobbin, it's obviously didn't like Houllier.
It's a bit of a what could have been era, isn't it? The Houllier one, where you think about Villa had just slipped off towards the end of the O'Neill era, and then Houllier sort of came in to try and just keep, you know, get the ship pointing back in the right direction. He brought Bent in. You thought, okay, well, it's 6 months too late, but we've got a goal scorer and we've still got the pieces of a good side. And then, of course, he left and McLeish ended up coming in, and it all started to, you know, fall apart pretty rapidly. And for McCoon, you know, McLeish didn't like the way he played. I think he farmed him out to Greece, where he actually won the title.
Olympiacos.
But, you know, to spend sort of £6 million on a player that only made 9 appearances from just a purely business point of view is a bad bit of business. But I think he feels like a player of what could have been, because he did have all the pieces of the, you know, the puzzle that would have worked for Villa, and probably suffered more because of the sort of the shambolic nature of Villa. I think he would have probably played under 3 different managers, you know, with obviously through the Houllier, McLeish, and then left during the Lambert era.
I always look forward to seeing him play when he was actually picked. Against United, he was all right on the ball, I remember. And he was like the master of the little 2-yard pass.
He was very much the keep the game ticking over kind of player.
Yeah, and literally, it was almost like the ball is a hot potato ticking over, if you know what I mean. As soon as it came to him, he was a first touch player.
It's one of those players that, unfortunately, if he didn't have his jumper, he would have been very forgettable. That's what he's going to be. He's going to be remembered for his jumper and for a two-footed lunge against Blackpool.
Yeah, and getting sent off.
Yeah. So
yeah, it was wrong place at the wrong time, I think, for Mr. Jean McCoon. And you can see why he was more suited to like the French league. And it's a bit like Jota going back to Spain. He probably would do better there, where it's a slower pace and his skill set comes to the fore a bit more. Underrated or overrated?
Phil?
I'm saying overrated because it was $6 million and he played
purely from
appearances.
I think just purely from a business point of view, it wasn't a good signing. That's not a blight on him as a player, but I think $6 million for 9 games is a shocking bit of business.
Yeah, see the fact that I can't, like, I usually kind of can't just go like easy, snap decision, yep, overrated, yep, underrated, shows that just how likable that jumper was whenever he came in. No, but I have to agree, he's overrated considering the reputation he came with. And only 9 games,
but it's wrong place, wrong time, and also what could have been if Houllier didn't have his health issues.
So much of it's not his fault, unfortunately.
Where was McCoon last seen? He's still playing, is he?
Yeah, so obviously he left Villa, went to Olympiacos, then he ended up out at Stade Rennais on loan, made that move permanent, where he did play games over a sort of a 2-year period, and then he went to Antalyaspor in Turkey, where again he had, you know, he tends to have like sort of 2 or 3 year windows at clubs and then moves on. I believe he's still playing.
Free agent in May, so he's hovering about again.
Yeah, he's looking for a club.
Fulham, where are you?
Birmingham City. Mm-hmm. But he's getting on a bit now. So how old is he? He's 37, is he not? Right, anyway. So next one, Mr. Warnock. Why did we buy Mr. Warnock? This was like one of those signings where you've bought players to do a job and they actually have turned out not to be good enough for what you signed them for. So you've had to get in somebody else. And I think this was the case of getting him in for Nicky Shorey.
Yeah, Boomer was injured. This was obviously a Martin O'Neill signing and quite a relatively big signing at the time, I remember. Boomer had obviously broken his leg in the Intertoto Cup, I think it was, and Shorey wasn't quite up to scratch. He was another one of these guys who'd had, you know, one good season at a newly promoted side and then didn't manage to make the step up.
This was a case of, right, let's throw some money at this and let's solve this bloody issue.
Yeah, because he'd left Liverpool as a youngster where he'd come up through the ranks and then went to Blackburn for, I think it was 2 seasons, had a couple of pretty good seasons there and a relatively steady Blackburn team. He looked like an oven ready player. And ready to make the step up to a slightly better side, which I think he did. You know, his first season was 09-10, and that was probably his best season I would say in probably his career, we got him at a good time in that first year. You know, he was stepping into a team that were, you know, really popping at the time. So he was playing in a good side, you know, as part of a good back four.
Kind of seen as the missing link to have a decent back four.
Yes. And also, obviously, because, you know, it was a case of, you know, square pegs in round holes. All of a sudden, you had a bit of balance with a natural left footer and a fullback who could get forward a little bit.
I remember him getting forward quite a bit. He always was in and around the box there. I mean, I don't want to sort of foreshadow anything that might happen to Matt Target, but he did remind me a bit of what Matt Target's like at the minute. Only Target is obviously younger and has time to improve. He's a similar type of play to him.
Yeah. Did he make the England squad?
He went to the South Africa World Cup, didn't he? Under Capello. Yeah. I think it was when Leighton Baines had got an injury, which isn't to blight his achievement. But I mean, I know Warnock didn't feature. He actually only ever made two appearances for England. Subsequently, because he would only actually ever played in friendlies, apparently in May 2012, he was approached by Scotland to play for them. Because of family reasons. Yeah, he didn't end up doing it. But he's a relatively forgettable one in terms of singular moments. I mean, I remember him scoring it was the first goal in the 6-4 mental firefight with Blackburn in the Cup semi-final of that season, and he got us back on track. Obviously, I think we were 2-0 down on the night. He got the first one back, and then we went on to blow through them.
Got a question: his defensive abilities if he's in that back four and he conceded four against that team.
And another unfortunate one for him was I think he would have been captain under McLeish, obviously because of Petrov's health issues, and he scored in the game against Bolton where we threw away the lead, lost 2-1, and it got very, very toxic. And it was in that run of games where I think we only we didn't win any of our last 10 games that season. It plunged us down the table towards the relegation zone from being relatively comfortable in mid-table. We just couldn't buy a win.
Yeah, the turning point of his career was that League Cup final when Valencia tore him apart for United.
Yeah.
I don't think his confidence ever recovered from that. Then after that, O'Neill leaves, Hullier comes in, and Hullier didn't like him, had previous with him, and just again victim of circumstance at the time, he just found himself out of the squad until McLeish came in and reinstated him.
Quickly, what was the previous with Hullier?
Well, he'd had him at the, you know, obviously through the youth ranks at Liverpool, and whether or not he rated him is, I'm sure that's open to debate, but he wasn't living in Birmingham at the time, and neither was Heskey. He was staying up, obviously he was from, you know, the Northwest. So he'd only stay a couple of nights of the week in Birmingham, and then he'd travel back and forth. Or if Villa played in the Northwest, they were allowed to do what they wanted and they could go straight home rather than having to travel on the bus. So apparently they played Manchester City away, got beat, surprise, surprise. And afterwards, a lot of the players went home, did their own thing. Julio had a huge fallout with him, saying, "Why did you do that? You didn't tell me." Demanded that Warnock apologise for his actions, which were justified. Julio just sort of, you know, denied ever saying that he was allowed to go home off his own back.
Give him the green light.
Yeah, and he basically said, "You know, you'll never play for Villa again."
Mm. Because the way you kind of saw it was he just had this shocking drop of form, and you thought, well, hang on a minute, he's an England international, although be it a fringe international, and he was, you know, reasonably regarded. Liverpool, there was John Arnorica at left back, which, I mean, you'd take Risa every time just because he's deadly shooting. So you can understand why he thought, well, I have to move on here and went to Blackburn. But he was considered definitely one of the best English left-backs. That's why we bought him, just to sort out that left-back problem.
Yeah, and then I think similar to McCoon, he just got sort of screwed over by the situation at the club. I mean, he'd have had that period under Julio, and Dalgleish went back to Liverpool and asked to go back there, you know, giving him a route out of Villa a route back home, essentially. And everything was sort of close to the deal. And then Villa tried to ask for more money, surprise, surprise, in that era, and Liverpool wouldn't pay it, so the deal fell through. So I think he basically just sat twiddling his thumbs for the rest of that season.
I always remember thinking, well, if he's suffering like so bad, if he's suddenly, like, in terms of form and ability, why are Liverpool interested? Or why is Dalgleish interested to get him back if he's that bad? It, you know, there must be something underfoot. Anyway, overrated or underrated?
I'm going to go underrated. I think he is a victim of circumstance and his own confidence. I mean, after that League Cup final, whenever he was, like I said, he was torn apart, he wasn't protected. He wasn't reintegrated into the team properly. I mean, Hullier coming in was just the nightmare scenario to him. I mean, like it would be for, like it was for John Carew as well. Whenever you're playing for a manager that doesn't rate you, if you'd say that, it's hard to turn that around no matter what you do.
I'm going to also give him the benefit of the doubt and say he was a little bit underrated, because I think it was all circumstances. He was another one of these lads, wasn't he? He was a very early member of the Paul Lambert bomb squad before he finally left in January 2013. And I think that first season, he showed what he could do. He just never got the opportunity to sort of push on. And then after that season, of course, the team was just, the whole club was sort of falling off a cliff. Slowly but surely. So I think he was just part of that. And similar to players like Hutton, you know, who maybe rode it out and managed to end it in a positive light, I don't think Warnock did as well. As much as he's sort of probably quite a relatively forgotten player, that first season at Villa, he was a good player.
I'm going overrated. When you're looking through and you're thinking, oh yeah, you know, when he scored the first goal in that game against Blackburn in the semi, you're thinking, well, hang on a minute, we conceded four. And then we're talking about when there was a bust up at Manchester City after we got beat there. And he's like, hang on a minute, we got beat 4-1. And there was
times. I'd stick my neck out and say it was probably because Guzan was in goal though.
Yeah,
it wasn't the cup games.
And I do remember some, dreadful positioning, and it got to the stage where you did feel weak down that left hand side. But yeah, I mean, you can obviously mitigate for everything that went on behind the scenes, but I'm going overrated because it was you remember at the time where you thought, yeah, we need another new left back, and it started to get a bit frustrated. But you're in the middle of the biggest meltdown of recent history at Villa, because that's when we were just fraying at the seams. Where is he now? He's
on the Beeb, isn't he? He's doing a bit of BBC stuff.
Yeah, that's kind of
BT
a surprise,
Sport.
Though. I mean, fair play to him, because it is kind of random who pops up as these pundits. Some people, I mean, he's all right. I mean, in terms of a lot of pundits manage to make it without being particularly articulate. And I'm talking about some major ones that don't really have much of, much diversity in what they actually say. And they've a bit of media training, and we're talking about England goal scorers here, have managed to forge careers out of it. Well, I wouldn't say that he's one of them. He's somebody who you wouldn't have expected to be high profile enough to break it, but he's made it on merit. Any opinions on him as a pundit?
He's one of the harmless ones, isn't he? Now, he's not one of those ones who sort of pushes people's buttons. He's not particularly controversial. Yeah. I think he's all right. He's reasonably erudite.
Is that not the last thing you want to be called as a pundit? Harmless? you're like a blunt sword.
He's not cut from the same cloth as like a Roy Keane, is he?
No, definitely not.
Robbie Savage.
Yeah, he hasn't got that bit of shithouse about him, or he's not going to be... He's very BBC, isn't he?
Right, anyway, we've cast our dies on those two players. Thank you for listening to the show. We look forward to Villa versus Leicester. Quite nice to have a break just to soak up that 7-2. Timing on the international break, I think Grealish alluded to it as a bad timing in terms of wanting to play again and carrying on.
Smith said the opposite though, didn't he? He said it was good to just take stock and...
I think I'll go with Smith.
And reset and not get too carried away.
Yeah, it's the same for the whole league, so...
You know, you just look at Leicester, won 5-2 against Manchester City 1 week, get beat 3-0 by West Ham the other, so it doesn't mean anything, does it? It doesn't mean that you can't wait to play the next game because the momentum's going to carry on.
Yeah.
I think this is such an anomaly, this game, that you do need a bit of time to refocus and think about what it means in terms of, you know, the players, not necessarily the fans. We know what it means. Right, anyway, thank you very much for joining us, and please do subscribe, and if you're on Apple, do drop us a review as well, and we shall be back. And until then, as our unbeaten run hopefully continues, our 100% league run continues as well, it's goodbye from me and it's goodbye from them.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee, and terms apply. See McDonald's.com.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.